If you are living in Scotland and working in contemporary art or theater, then you are living in the shadow of Richard DeMarco, whether you know it or not. An Italian Scot who has altered the cultural landscape of Scotland in thousands of different ways, from founding the Traverse Theater with Jim Haynes and building the Edinburgh Fringe Festival up, to bringing the work of pioneering artists like Joseph Boys and Tadeusz Kantor to Scotland for the first time. He has staged work at every Edinburgh festival to date and is particularly renowned for bringing contemporary visual art to that festival and for plugging Scotland into the dynamic and challenging art scene which was happening in Europe at the time. In 2010, the Royal Scottish Academy held a retrospective of his career to date, and it was a celebration of over 50 years spent supporting and promoting artists. The day I went to visit the exhibition, DeMarco was actually there, and he was leading this small tour around the galleries with the manic enthusiasm of someone who had just discovered the work yesterday, pointing things out, dragging people along from one to the other, hardly giving him a chance to pause and look at it, just going. He was full of energy. He is passionate about art, about what art does, and what it can inspire people to do. It isn't entertainment, and it isn't always happy, and it isn't always even understandable. But art is powerful, and art is important, and it was a pleasure for me to sit down with Richard DeMarco amongst his archive at Summerhall in Edinburgh and to remember exactly why.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls, casting pots of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
My real name is Ricardo DeMarco. My mother called me Rico. Bit too much for the Scots. So I'm simply Richard.
Richard, I mean, I guess I think of you as a brilliant curator, and you've lived a life of art and culture here in Scotland. And what do you consider yourself? How do you describe yourself when people ask you?
That's a very interesting view that you have. Although I have presented something like maybe 6,000 exhibitions, theatre productions, events, lectures. I even created my own idea of a university of the arts, inspired by Black Mountain College in the States, which was really an offshoot of the famous Bauhaus. My life has been, therefore, born as I was in 1930, all about being an Italo-Scot, living in a country which had a smattering of Italians. A country which got itself involved in what was called World War II. I don't think it was World War II. It was simply the second half of a stupid idea, which was World War I. The two teams got themselves organized so that in the second half, the so-called losers got themselves organized so they were prepared to win. And there was a huge struggle, and it had a devastating effect on anyone who happened to belong to that generation, including my parents and the Italian community here. They suffered greatly because they were regarded as a threat to security. They were obviously enemies, which is nonsense. They were not the kind of people who would have betrayed this country. They were honest, hardworking people. Now, in America, the Japanese were treated in the same way as the Italians here. But the American government eventually made an official apology to the Japanese community and said, "We're sorry that we bound you up like enemies." I'm still waiting for the British government to say, "Sorry, we treated you unfairly." Now, I therefore feel we're living in a very strange world from that of the 1930s. We are in a world dominated by information overload, and this dominates our lives so that we no longer communicate in the age-old way where one human being confronts another. We imagine that we can communicate instantaneously with someone else through basically the internet. And it's all about the distance that now separates us electronically from the mystery of the human presence. So therefore, I have committed myself to the language of the arts, which is the one language, I suppose, given to human beings from the gods. And there's no star, no constellation, nothing outside the world of this planet which is more important than the presence of a human being.
What gets me is this to you, I mean, the reason you're involved in all of these art forms simultaneously, yeah, is about communication and, I guess, engagement. Your kind of interest in sort of finding artists and looking out for artists has led you to find some really edgy, complicated, difficult and challenging work, things that people, in this effort to, I wonder what you think about this, in this effort to communicate through art, what led you, do you think, to finding work that was so challenging, and what was it that attracted you to that kind of work? To a lot of people, I think they would consider that anti-communication almost.
You know, being a human being means that you live only a very short time. You have limitations which are to do with the fact that if you stretch your arms out, they don't go very far. You can only see up to the point of the horizon. My job is to persuade human beings that they should extend with the language of the arts their idea of where they are. But art is misunderstood, because art, if you look at the history of the Edinburgh Festival, and the Edinburgh Festival is supposed to be the model for the world's festivals, the festival is now not about art, not about culture on the highest level. It's essentially about entertainment.
I got in a little trouble the other week because I was talking to some young students, you know, some poets, and I said poetry is not entertainment. God. And they got really angry.
Well, they must have. Right. Well, all art ascends, if it's really worth tuppence, to the dimension, the quality of prayer. If you can't pray, and most people find it impossible to pray now, they prefer to talk about meditation. There's a difference. Prayer is acknowledging your limitations as a creature, something created, like a tree, like a plant, like a leaf, like a cloud. We are creatures, and we're here for a very short time. But we are inextricably linked to every other aspect of creaturedom. So the great poems, the great novels, is to remind us of that.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting thing that you're talking about, because you're talking about, I think, in through all of this has been one profound respect for the individual and the creative soul of the individual, but at the same time using that as a way of understanding what binds us together, and that's what the role of art is. And very much in your life, that seems to be what you've done.
My eyes are always fixed on any race at the two or three people, the runners, whoever they are, or the rowers, who are losers.
Yeah, I like those guys too.
I'm not interested in the people who win. I'm interested in the poor people who have to lose so that others can win. And nobody should be told, you have won, you are special. I'm against that. I'm for the people who lose, because art is about dealing with human weakness and dealing with the fact that no matter how hard you try, you aren't going to win. There's no such thing as a winner, not in this world. And I love what Beckett said when somebody was asking him, you know, how do you do it, Sam? I want to be a great playwright like you. How do you do it? And all he could say was, I don't know how I do it. I try, and then I try again. Then I try harder. And then I fail, and I fail again, and I fail harder. That's what it's about.
There's not enough room for failure anymore. I mean, this is my concern with the way things are. It's hard to fail now.
In art schools and things like that, nobody's allowed to fail. Everybody's given whatever it is, something to reassure them that they haven't wasted their time. When everybody knows in their heart that the only judge can be yourself. That's why, for example, the great artist, Cézanne, it's why he painted Mont Saint-Victoire over 50 times. He didn't get it right.
Didn't Michelangelo smash his own work loads of time.
I love the last piece of Michelangelo, the Pietà of Christ in the arms of his mother. It was a masterpiece, obviously, you know, beautiful. And then the age of 80, oh, by the way, he wasn't an emerging artist, was he? Wasn't a child. You know, nowadays, everybody's got to be emerging. Otherwise, they're not completing a life's work. No, he decided to start again. So this masterpiece, which you've got to go to Milan to see, is about trying again, failing. And this is my job, to help people to fail. Joseph Beuys said everyone is an artist, and that included the people banged up in the special unit, people like Jimmy Ball, murderers. It certainly included everybody on death row. It certainly included everyone who is in a nursing home waiting to die. You know, it certainly is everyone in a hospice waiting to die. Everyone's an artist. Nobody gets left off the hook. But art is not therapy. I've got to make that clear. The highest level of art expression is enough. I don't mean therapeutic art. I mean just art. Looking at the final painting of Van Gogh, of the crows flying across that cornfield, is what you have to get people to take seriously. He didn't know that in doing so, he was going to create an object which would be valued at auction at well over $100 million. That's the mystery of art. So art isn't capital, not money, because he didn't make it to make money. He made it for another reason. You've got to examine what that reason is, because everything now is about getting people to pass exams so they get pieces of paper, which are useless anyway, so that they can get a job. A job doing what? Beuys was worried about the fact that most people don't like the job they eventually have to do, and it becomes, they'll come robotic. They lose their humanity. Anyway, my job is to take people away on a journey which leads to a coastline, to a harbour, a port, and so therefore they're travelling over land and sea. If they get to the Edinburgh Festival, if it leads them to the Edinburgh Festival, they'll have a different state of mind. They'll have the state of mind of the Argonauts. And they won't be that, they won't be focused completely on the Edinburgh Festival. The Edinburgh Festival is simply another nodal point. And I need to work with great artists, great poets. Basically, when I asked Joseph Beuys, what is your art? He said, my art is my teaching. Now, most people teaching in art schools find teaching a bore because they really want to be artists. So I think that's bad. For me, a great artist could be 75-year-old Marion Campbell working on a loom that she made when she was 15, producing the best Harris tweed in the world on the same old loom. She is a maker of Harris tweed. She loves that loom. You have to go to that little hamlet on the island of Harris to find her. Just look at her. Just look at her stuff and be amazed. That's a great artist. A great artist is the man who built that road that nobody wanted him to build, linking the little hamlet where he lived on the island of Rasi, Callum's Road, I think it was called. That's a masterpiece. Beuys said famously, don't think that the horizon is your idea of how you measure things, where you are on the planet in time and space. No. The great sailor never looks at the horizon. The great sailor, the fisherman, knows that it's the gift to see beyond the horizon. It's called the offing, Dutch sailor's term, for the space where you can't see the storm brewing, you can't see the enemy fleet, you can't see the shoal of herring.
It's in the offing. Yeah, I didn't realize.
It's in the offing. Now, how many politicians are working according? Where are they bloody well looking? They're looking at the horizon. They have to measure everything. They have to quantify everything. You have to make feasibility studies. You have to prove that you're going to succeed. You have to, as far as I'm concerned, when you're dealing with a great artist, you have to prove that you're going to fail. I mean, it's built in to human endeavor that you're going to fail. All human life is about failure. There's practically nothing which suggests a perfect life. You always have, I mean, you know, people like, my favorite people like St. Thomas Aquinas, the great philosopher. When he was dying, somebody said, you know, you must feel satisfied. You created the great work of philosophy. And he said, my work as a philosopher on his deathbed is a heap of straw. And that's the same with Einstein. When Einstein was told, you know, you can go now to your death feeling satisfied, he said, no, that's nothing. All great people know that. If they don't know that and they're in love with their achievements, they're second rate. I love the fact that I can read the plays of Shakespeare, which are failures. And even in the great works of genius, which he produces, there is a hint of the incomplete, the failure. So how are we going to teach people how to fail and accept failure? The idea that unless there's a risk involved in what you do, don't do it. Don't play a team that's going to be a walkover. Don't run a race where you aim simply to win. Run a race so that you do your best, taking into account that there are people who are going to lose, and be content to allow someone else to win. Nobody wins a cup. Like, whoever's going to win at Wimbledon, whatever, it depends on all the people who are not going to get there to the final. Right. I mean, we've got to understand that. We've got to stop this nonsense. Winners and losers. Everybody's a loser. This is our condition. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. It's my fault, it's my fault. It's my greatest, great fault. We have to see that born as we are, to live for a very short time. I mean, I'm speaking as someone who has experienced being alive for 70 years. When you reach your 70th, you know you're living from then on in extra time. Shakespeare tells you that, the seven stages of man. The whole idea that seven seems to be a magic number. But what happens when you get to your 80s, as I am now? You've got to face the fact you're living the game of life in penalty shootout time. This is the age of fame and celebrity and success. How the hell has that affected the Edinburgh Festival? I think very severely. I think the Edinburgh Festival now is about the numbers game. It's all about more and more and more and more productions. Now, in a real festival, there's always a guarantee of an audience. Yeah. You know, when you talk about the other festivals, Salzburg Festival, the fringe is a very strange thing. By the way, you cannot have a fringe. It's a meaningless term. A fringe belongs to a curtain. When the curtain goes up, the fringe goes up at the same time, doesn't it, right? Yeah. And when the curtain comes down, the fringe comes down. Now, the Edinburgh Festival is such that the fringe doesn't even happen at the same time. And it's not joined. Well, there's something wrong there. I think that what's going on in this place here, Summer Hall, but in a funny kind of way, it reminds me of the Traverse. Traverse was a tiny space. Tiny. It was born out of the festival. Born out of Jim Haynes' tiny little bookshop called The Paperback. Born out of the concept of opera on a hillside in Kinrosha, which is the world of John Calder. Born out of a tiny group of people wanting the spirit of the festival in the 50s to be extended all year round. Born out of the idea that if you have a theatre, you also have a club, a small group of people who will defend it to the death. born out of the idea that with a theatre you must have an absolutely outstanding international gallery. Born out of the idea that if you go and see a play, you should meet the actors afterwards and have a drink with them in a bar, eat with them. And so it's a whole experience beyond the business of going into a theatre, sitting at a seat, coming out, and just simply being reduced to the level of being an audience, member of an audience. The Travers destroyed the idea that you were a member of an audience. You were an integral part of what was going on. By the way, what was going on was in an impossible space, because the acting space was 14 feet by 9. The height above the head of the tallest actor, well, you had to make sure that the actor was not over 6 feet, because they bumped their head on the low ceiling. It wouldn't be allowed now. Health and safety would intervene, so you can't have it. The Travers came into being because there had to be a place where the official festival and the Fringe met. It was something better than the so-called official festival club in the assembly rooms. It was a place where you'd meet Lord Harwood, director of the festival, and you'd meet the group of people who were running the Fringe, and you meet all the actors, and you bump into the world's greatest makers of the arts, and you'd be dining until 2 or 3 in the morning if you wanted to. You'd realize you're talking to Edward Albee, J.B. Priestley, Lillian Hellman, Ken Tynan, people who more or less defined culture. It wasn't a place where you could guarantee laughter. Jean-Paul Sartre's huis clos about hell, the kind of hell that's created with human beings, they create.
Yeah. Is that hell is other people?
Hell is other people, yeah. I don't believe that. I believe that hell can be other people, but can also be... Yeah, I mean, other people can provide you with heaven as well. So, basically, I'm not a pessimist. Basically, I have high hopes that eventually, sooner or later, with the help of the people who could possibly find a home for this archive. This archive is a Gesamtkunstwerk. It's a German word for total artwork. It's not passing show. It's about something now that is really essentially about, it's about academic research, okay? It's about university students and academics and artists thinking about it, using it. It's about the history of the festival, the history of the paperback, Jim Haynes' paperback, the history of the life of heaven knows how many artists.
Travers, all of it's in there. That Kent, basically,
everyone
you've worked with in your career.
Yeah, everything. So where's it going to be? It's about the history of the war, this thing called World War One and Two. It's this one world war. It's about the living and the dead and the unborn. The Department of Italian Studies at Edinburgh University, run by a marvelous woman who's, I think, a great artist, who has presented me with something I should have known about, which is the world of Carlo Emilio Gadda, the great Italian writer. She, I hope, will be able to help me deal with the 100th anniversary of the First World War, well, the 100th anniversary of the global madness that gave us the Battle of Stalingrad, the D-Day landings, the Battle of Monte Cassino, and the which has caused vast numbers of people to be displaced and to be seen as immigrants in this country. I'm talking about the Poles now. I love Poland. I can't live without Poland. Maybe explain why I had to cross the Iron Curtain 97 times. That was quite an effort. That's like moving in the wrong direction. Should be going to the United States. I went to the United States about 30 or 40 times during the same period, but I always knew I was going in the wrong direction. The real testing ground of humanity was the biggest prison that the world had ever seen, which was Europe, that part of Europe under the command of the army of Stalin. I lived 50 years of my life through that. And most of the great artists like Cantor belong to that world. I brought them all here. That's my job.
Well, if you want to see any of that stuff, I mean, there's photographs, there's maps, there's loads of text and history, poems, prints, everything is here in Summer Hall. You won't be able to see it all. It changes a little bit all the time.
Well, yeah. It changes, but eventually there has to be... These rooms you're looking at now, they represent 1/50th of the total.
It's a small smattering of what you have in your archives, which is hidden in a warehouse somewhere in Scotland. But do come check it out, and you know, might even get a chance to meet Mr. Richard. Richard, thank you so much for talking to us.
Well,
I really, really appreciate it.
Richard DeMarco, everybody. Thanks to him for not only taking the time to sit with me, but also for his long-term commitment to arts and artists. He's a remarkable man. If you're interested, you can see a wealth of his archives upstairs at Summer Hall in Edinburgh. It is totally worth popping in. It's free, and the scope of DeMarco's work and influence is actually pretty spectacular. We're going to close this episode with a song from Billy Lyre about making work that matters. This is called Change, and it's from his latest EP called All I've Got, which you can get on Bandcamp. You can find out more about Billy Lyre on BillyLyreMusic.com, where he's got a brand new video for Change up right now. And he's playing at the Banshee Labyrinth in Edinburgh on the 15th of February, and the Counting House as part of Rally and Broad on the 21st of February. Details of all of his music and more shows are all on his website. Check it out, and we'll be back with you next week. Here he is, Billy Lyre with Change.
Put away my party shoes, and I cut off my mohawk. I need to back up my arguments and not just be all talk. I'm so bored of watching bands all just fade into the same song, the same band. No one's saying anything, nothing's getting done. I wanna see your blood spilt on the stage. I wanna hear your heartbeat through the PA. I want to hear true adolescent rage. I want to be inspired, I want to see something change. I'm tired of drinking until the band get better. I want to hear bands that make me dance even when I'm sober. Reunion tours, rocking the cash box, did you get back together when hell was frozen over? I want to see your blood spilt on the stage. I want to hear your heartbeat through the PA. I want to hear true adolescent rage. I want to be inspired. I want to see something change. Is that too much to ask? Probably. I wanna see your blood spilled on the stage. I wanna hear your heartbeat through the PA. I want to hear true adolescent rage. I want to be inspired. I want to see something. I wanna see your blood spilled on the stage. I wanna hear your heartbeat through the PA. I want to hear true adolescent rage. I want to be inspired. I want to see something change.
This episode of Culture Laser has been supported with the generous assistance of Creative Scotland.